This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast, and here I am once more with my money-making co-host. Hello, Jan.
Money-making. Does that mean I'm printing it myself?
That would be forgery, probably illegal. Let's say no.
It's all the rage on TikTok these days, so not that I go to TikTok, but I read a news article this morning. I don't know.
Moving on.
Well, we have our crypto coin coming up soon, so.
Oh dear. Yes. Okay. Less said about that, the better. Anyway. We have a little bit of a different episode today. We are going to do a bit of a deep dive case study on how and why is it so damn hard to make money from open source. What do you think, Jan? Should this be easy?
Well, considering that we are publishing our podcast under the open document something something license, which is an open source license, I haven't seen the checks rolling in, so I guess we're doing something wrong, or are we doing something exactly right? Because is profitability something you should be interested in when you're doing an open source project?
Well, we're going to be talking about
easy question to start with
from the perspectives of not of individuals but of organizations that are behind or sponsoring or largely driving their open source based projects, and therefore yes, those organizations by and large are absolutely looking for money at some point in this journey.
But why? Are you saying the people working with these companies want to be paid?
Yeah, unfortunately.
That's
so
insane.
They want to be paid. They want to, you know, money to feed their children and themselves.
And they have to have money to keep the project in the air and make sure that it doesn't crumble and stuff like that. I mean, that's stupid. That can't be. Come on.
I'm afraid so. However, I would, you know, to add a little disclaimer here before we get into the meat of the episode, I would say that I'm an idiot, I know nothing, and my opinions are my own, and data is what I found on the internet, etc. So, you know, much like all of the rest of our episodes. This is,
and just to say, I mean, everything I know I learned from Dave, so.
Yeah, I mean, that tells you a lot right there.
It was a short education, I must admit.
30 seconds, done. Anyway, it was a magical 30 seconds there. So we're going to talk about this with a case study, and that case study is going to be HashiCorp. And I picked HashiCorp for a couple of reasons. One is they've been around for a reasonable period of time, like they've gone through the journey, as it were. Two, they've got some very, very successful open source, and we will get to that a little bit later. And you know, thirdly, that journey has, depending on how you view it, sort of come to an end in a way that perhaps, you know, some folks were not expecting with their, and you know, it's not necessarily an end to their acquisition by IBM, but it's their end as an independent organization. And there are a few interesting points around how that sort of all happened, why it happened, all that sort of thing. So this kind of case study or story or how whatever you want to call it out. Also, I'll mainly be talking about Terraform through this, as I think it's fair to say that that is HashiCorp's sort of flagship product / project. Terraform is the generally speaking known as the de facto standard for all things infrastructure as code, and you know, if you look at the various other options out there, very few of them, you know, have been as successful. Again, you know, depending on how you define success as Terraform. Yeah, I think with that, unless you've got anything else here, we can probably dive into a bit of history. What do you think?
Maybe just something that I've always asked myself. I've always seen Terraform mostly as a cloud infrastructure builder. I don't see them used a lot in on-premise situations. Is that a correct view, if I'm just being myopic here? And I'm not talking about private cloud on-premise. I mean, that would also be cloud, obviously.
I think that, unfortunately, at this point, my reality distortion bubble is so cloud-oriented, I probably couldn't give you a good answer for that.
Well, my bubble is just different because I work in the public sector where cloud is kind of, yes, available, but a minimal thing. And I have, in the last 6 years that I worked at my current employer, never had a discussion with my customers about Terraform. Could just be me, of course.
Yeah. Don't know the answer to that, I'm afraid.
Okay.
All right.
Give the history lesson. Come on.
Yeah. So we're gonna dip in and out of history as we go through this. There are points where we're gonna pause and talk about various things, but we can start off back. Do you remember 2012, Jan? What were you doing in 2012?
I was just 1 year in the Netherlands, so I was really trying to figure out if a bike was a good thing or not.
Okay, now I've got to ask, was a bike a good thing?
Yes, unless you had to do like 200 kilometers per day to the office and back, then you do train and bike, and I gave up and I bought a car. But I tried it for a year, so I'm proud of myself.
Good. I just left Red Hat. I just joined Canonical. And I was learning all about Ubuntu and very, very early stages of OpenStack. Maybe Ubuntu back then.
Oh, I was deep in Open Nebula, the big competitor of OpenStack. We were competitors. Yay.
Indeed.
Well, I was working for the government, anyway. So I couldn't be commercial at all.
Well, that's what we were doing back in 2012. However, other things happening in 2012, HashiCorp started. HashiCorp even started. And their first product was Vagrant. Do you remember Vagrant? Did you ever use it?
Same. I looked at it. That was also kind of a building thing. It was to build small VMs. So when we looked at Open Nebula, we also looked at OpenStack, and we did play around with Vagrant. I think Chef was also kind of connected in that ecosystem. They had a nice integration with each other. So I had some events and conferences that I went to that this came up. To be fair, the Open Nebula thing we were using kind of had their own internal orchestration layer, which kind of meant, okay, once you made that decision, we didn't have to look at Vagrant and Terraform anymore. But in those days, I really saw Vagrant as the important thing, and Terraform Chef things that depended upon it. And boy, was I wrong.
It's weird though, isn't it? Because I remember people using Vagrant, as you say, like to kind of build VMs for things. And, you know, it's a sign of the times, really, isn't it? But like how much that world has changed. Like this is like, it's no longer about kind of building sort of a bunch of relatively bespoke, at least from my memory and from my experiences of seeing where it was used and seeing people using it. Like there was a whole bunch of weird, random, bespoke engineering that went into all of the different VMs that people were creating. And okay, they were doing it in a more automated way with Vagrant, but yeah, it's very different to the cloud image type world that we think of today.
Yeah, but you had that whole movement around certified VM images then. So having an automated way to build your VM images was very useful. And you could either go with a golden image and then have config management to update it, which broke your certified image. So that was bad. So you kind of had to have something like Vagrant to build a trusted VM, which I never understood, because the moment you launch the VM in a virtual machine, Wild West, anything could happen there. But that was something I really struggled with for, I think, 3 years in that era. to fight against that wish, that demand, especially in government situations, for certified images. And I think now looking back, that's where I touched Vagrant the most, to see if there was one way of actually making this work. Terraform, obviously, being the idea that it builds it more dynamically, is kind of the antithesis, it's a difficult word, which you can probably pronounce better than me, of that whole concept, which I liked way more as a concept.
Yeah. No, so that definitely aligns with my my experiences as well.
As I said, everything I know I learned from you.
It's a worrying thought. Anyway, moving on a little bit to two more years down the line, 2014. HashiCorp had a few more things under their belt. They'd kind of released things like Consul and Packer, and Terraform existed as well. And they sort of came up with this bundle of things. Terraform, Consul, Packer, and Vagrant all together under this brand of Atlas. And slight aside, like, why does everybody call their products Atlas? There are so many products out there called Atlas. It's a terrible name.
Atlas has the world on its shoulder. Suffer so much.
Oh, it's awful. But this was kind of I remember at the time thinking this was a little bit strange, because it was definitely oriented more towards like small to medium businesses. It didn't seem at the time to have any form of like real enterprise focus. It was just like a bunch of stuff bundled together. Here's a price and support, which was a little bit strange.
Yeah, but that's kind of we're talking about how to get open source profitable, and this is kind of the first kernel of sand building the sandcastle that isn't in the end not sustainable. Most of these very popular projects are just the ones that we know about because they became popular. But all of these projects in open source have started because somebody had an idea that he didn't want to do the same thing over and over and over again. So I'm going to build something automation around it, make it a project, and hey, other people like it too, and let's put it on GitHub. And that's how these things grow. There are very little, if any, projects that are currently major, let's call them commercial enterprises, that started from day one with, I'm going to become a millionaire by building this thing. If people would start that way, I would be very surprised if they would start at open source. And that's why I really hate that reasoning behind, hey, they start this project as open source, so it has to remain open source forever now because they made the promise. Sure, whatever they made open source should remain open source. You can't go back. But there is no... That's the good thing about open source. Anybody can take that, and as long as it's not a GNU viral license, they can make something non-open source around from it. The whole idea of open source was originally, hey, I've got this great idea. If anybody wants to use this idea in whatever they're building, have fun with it. And please, if you can, also give it back to the community. But it has never been a quid pro quo.
The interesting thing is, like you mentioned, that is often the sort of the first step. And I think that's true. And I also think that 2017, again, moving on just 3 years now, is very often the second step that organizations take when they've got an open source, core project. Need to make sure I get project and product correct. But they then did a hard pivot of their business towards quote unquote enterprise, and everything had enterprise slapped on it with a giant sticker, and that was all about you can deploy your own private version, or as you say, like automation around it, built-in kind of extra authentication so you can integrate it with your sort of underlying identity and access management platform, your enterprise identity and access management platform, you know, obviously enterprise grade support and all those sorts of things. But the challenge was at this point, so many organizations had already adopted Terraform, and they, you know, they couldn't wait the time for those things to turn up. They ended up basically rolling a lot of their own sort of authentication and integration with everything else that they were doing. So by the time a lot of this stuff came round, people had already figured out a lot of these kind of challenges and were fairly happy with what they were doing.
Yeah, but that's inherent, isn't it? Because you're right, it's like the second standard step. You have your project, it's become popular, let's make it enterprise now. Now, why do you make that step? Because apparently people like it and are building all this cool stuff around it that makes us less important. We kind of want that back again, because now in the back of my head, I'm starting, maybe we should go for an IPO on this. You know what? We have to get new leadership. Let's hire an external manager to take over the technical roadmap and maybe even a C-level, CEO levels. And you kind of get an infiltration of infiltration by design of enterprise culture. Typically, you get managers from Salesforce or IBM or something like that in. And I'm not sure if that's happened with HashiCorp, because I don't really know what their changes were, but quite often that all happens a bit at the same time. And it's all of the snake eating their own tail. If there hadn't been all of the other people building their own little security, whatever, things around it, there wouldn't have been the signal for HashiCorp that, hey, people really want to use us in production, in money-generating endeavors, because they want to have it secure now. I guess we got a golden goose here. I want to get some of those golden eggs myself, so let's see if we can build an enterprise thing around it so people don't have to build their own thing. So it's not a negative thing, it's not a positive thing, it's just a normal consequence of how the world is looking at what you just built. And I do agree, however, that the change in direction is quite often too severe. It's like, and I think that's because the hiring of external managers that come in with their own background from a non-open source background, and they just, from day one, that's how it works, right? And the external manager comes in and now everything's going to change because this is the new way forward, and that's how it has to happen. And I think people in these projects don't give their users enough credit, because it's not of always a danger, not say always, sometimes it is, and we'll go into that later probably, but it's not always a danger when somebody is building cool stuff around your project. Let them do that and slowly build something yourself, or ask these people, hey, do you want to donate this to the project? We'll incorporate it. And it's not a problem to give that a couple of years, and you'll probably have a lot less struggles, we don't call it, around when you actually do make that enterprise. The ideal way to make it happen is by making it happen organically, where people actually don't notice something changed until off at some point they see, hey, things changed. And that's the right way to do it. But the moment that people have this IPO twinkle in their eyes, it's like a race. And yeah. But it's the same. It's the race of profitability. It's the same thing we're talking about.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult for. I mean, I've been through this journey a number of times with a number of different organizations. It's very, very difficult for a company to. I almost want to say, like, keep its culture intact. Like, culture continues to evolve always, but it's very difficult for it to keep its culture intact while it's actually going through that journey. I'm not sure it's impossible. I do think it's very, very, very difficult.
There's so much pressure from the outside, yeah. So much expectation. Yeah. And again, because everybody did it, it's now the roadmap to follow. If you want to be a unicorn, then you have 2 years for this, 2 years for that, 3 years for that, and then you must be this. And if you're not following that, you're a failure. even though you can be wildly successful. And we kind of have to break with that. We need to have people that are courageous enough to say, that was a roadmap from last decade. Today, we do things differently. But of course, the world doesn't get less capitalistic.
Or like the founders and senior leadership folks being, I think you're right, courageous is definitely the right word, enough to say, but that's not my company.
Exactly.
Like my company doesn't fit that cookie cutter, ideal, perfect, timeline, because I want to do it right. And it's going to take a bit longer in this stage, and maybe we'll be a bit shorter in that stage. But I want my organization to behave, end up, whatever it might be, in a certain way. And I think that's very, I think it's probably very difficult for folks to embrace that, because that is not what it's not what things like venture capitalists want to hear.
Exactly.
Like, they want to hear that you're on that that
proven track,
tight, aggressive timeline, and you're going to hit all of those steps at the right point, and so on and so forth.
We're going to focus back on HashiCorp and how to do this, but we're running a bit late here, so I think, unless you want to finish off with a brilliant thought.
Yeah, I just want to add one more thing here. Like, we talked about the fact that many organizations had sort of solved the problems HashiCorp's enterprise offerings had, but if you hadn't solved that already, but you had some other kind of major ISVs technology in there, whether it's Red Hat, SUSE, Dell, AWS, GCP, Azure, even IBM, they also had by this time very much cottoned on to the fact that, oh, this Terraform stuff is cool. Oh, this Terraform stuff is everywhere. Therefore, let's make sure that we also have a management platform for Terraform, or let's make sure that Terraform is supported in our existing management platform, which is what a lot of organizations did. And a little bit foreshadowing, you can almost smell the reason why HashiCorp later on ended up changing their license to something more restrictive, because of this kind of situation happening. And this, I think, was one of the first major milestones along the journey that HashiCorp ended up taking. But
let's go back to that next week, because that is all the time we have for today. You can support this podcast, you can become a patron, contributions to help us do this in-depth research that Dave has done this on his own lonesome for this once.
That's why it's so bad.
We're on YouTube. You can watch us there in full color. And in the next couple of episodes, we will have pretty graphs on the screen, so you might have a look there. We're at www.roaringalpha.org there with our webpage. You get links there to the Patreon page, YouTube page, and you can send feedback by email to podcast@roaringalpha.org. Until next time, my name is My Genome is Closed Source. Yul.
My name is Deep in the Research, Dave.
I look forward to talking to you again about more research next week. Goodbye.
See you then.